Welcome back to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock bands. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, Rick Nielsen and Robin Zander of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees Cheap Trick return to share some more of their very best.
Welcome back. I'm Robin Zander from Cheap Trick.
And I'm Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick, and we're in the studio. And
when we left off last week, Cheap Trick's guitarist, songwriter Rick Nielsen and singer Robin Zander told us about their 1979 live breakthrough album, Cheap Trick at Budokan. You may know the details of the unlikely hit album, so unpredictable that we have dedicated an entire episode of In the Studio just to it. But unless you actually live through it, there's no way of imagining what such a fluke phenomenon does to the individual heads of the band members, the management, and their American record label. The explosive success obviously builds tremendous momentum and inspires confidence, but the sudden runaway popularity can set the expectations bar unrealistically high for everything to follow. The story of Cheap Trick's turning point at Budokan actually begins in summer 1978, following the release of Cheap Trick's third studio album called Heaven Tonight. It's a five-star, near-perfect masterpiece that precious few in America heard that year. First, Cheap Trick singer Robin Zander, then guitarist Rick Nielsen in the studio.
At this time, when Surrender came out on the radio in the States, it was received fair airplay. It was probably the most played song of that summer, but in Japan, it was massive. It was huge. It was the biggest thing. It was unbelievable for us. You can imagine going from playing small theaters and opening shows for, being the most famous, in 3 years, being the most famous opening act around, and just playing small places and clubs and stuff like that still, going to the airport in Japan, and having 5,000 people meet you at the airport. I mean, it was total
chaos. It wasn't just because of Heaven Tonight, because we'd had three hit singles in a row over there,
right,
where we had, like, no hit singles. You know, we were getting airplay in the States, but over there, we had hit singles, which we had no other place on earth. I Want You to Want Me, the original studio version.
That was from In Color.
And Clock Strikes 10. And
Old Candy from the first album.
We got played. All that stuff got played. We were getting fan mail like mad. We didn't have any idea. It was like, wow, people like us. Whoa.
For any band to sort of feel what was like for maybe the Stones or the Beatles to play in the States for the first time.
But wait a minute,
it's a rare thing.
We didn't know what was going on there. We were getting letters.
We got letters. We really didn't know. It was a culture shock for us, for sure. We didn't really know the impact that we had on that country. We had no idea.
We had a promoter that says,
you guys are really doing great. What's that mean?
We didn't think, we were still, the, like Robin said, the world's most famous third on the bill act or whatever, but you guys are big here. We are, you don't even think about it.
Big is a word that we didn't understand at that time. that big. I mean,
would you guys like to go to Japan? Okay, well, yeah, sure. I'd like to go to Mars too.
Goodbye, dinosaur.
Trix cover version of Antoine Fats Domino's New Orleans Chestnut was one of three hit singles to eventually score for Cheap Trick, but it's a true rock miracle that would take a full year to develop. Robin Zander and Rick Nielsen recall Cheap Trick's first arrival for a series of concerts in Japan mid-1978.
We got to the airport, we got off the plane, and it was pandemonium. We couldn't do anything. We got into our cars and we were driving to the hotel, and there must have been, you know, there was a traffic jam behind us of fans that were following us to the hotels. We had to put shit up on the windows so nobody could see what hotel rooms we were at. There were thousands of people downstairs.
This is how everybody gets treated over here.
Yeah, we didn't know.
This is strange.
People are telling us how polite the Japanese audience was, and they sit in their chairs and stuff. The first show we did, girls were jumping off the balconies and stuff.
Down on the stage, it's like, what the heck is going on here?
We had the Tokyo Patrol following us everywhere. Each guy had three security officers assigned to him everywhere.
We had just left Iowa, and nobody cared.
Right, so you can imagine the culture shock.
For all of us.
Redbeard, we're asked that question all the time.
Still to this
and
day.
We don't know why it happened. It just did.
I think they got free McDonald's hamburgers or something. I don't know.
Not only that, but our demographics in the States up to that point were still pretty much, over 17, 16, 17. That was the youngest. And when we got to Japan, we had 13, 14-year-old, 15, 16-year-old girls. Almost the whole audience was... There were maybe a few guys there, but I mean, it was just all young girls.
It was like a teen thing that, we were older than that, but it was like... It was like this. It was so weird, but the record company over there said, "You guys have, had three or four hits over here. What we would like to do for your Japanese fans," and after we're there, we started to realize it. We want to make a record. We want to record you guys while you're here, for a special tribute to your Japanese fans, which you don't have in the States. Want to make a live record, just as a memento to them. Would you guys do it? Well, gee, I guess so. And we were sort of like, yeah, nobody else really cared that much.
The Dream Police record was pretty much there. We hadn't finished it yet, but,
We took time out during the Dream Police to do this tour.
Right. We did the Budokan live album while we were there. When we came back, we finished up the Dream Police record. We finished the Dream Police record. It was in the can. We were ready to release the Dream Police record. And that's how long it took for it to get from Japan to the States. Or, it went, I guess Jem picked it up. Jem distributed it first to England and Canada.
Yeah, it was released.
And it got big worldwide before it was big in the States. It
wasn't even supposed to be released.
See you. than the judge and jury on anyone.
Cheap Trick had actually interrupted the making of their fourth studio album called Dream Police in order to do that first tour of Japan. The recordings of that tour, including Cheap Trick's performance at the Tokyo Budokan Hall, were never intended to be sold or distributed anywhere outside of Japan. Here's Rick Nielsen, followed by Robin Zander.
It was never supposed to be released.
Oh, no.
Our manager said to us, These pictures, we had to rush, you know, to put the pictures out that were on the cover. He said nobody will never see the light of day in the United States.
Tom Werman,
you know, famous last words.
We sent the tapes off after we recorded in Budokan. We sent the tapes off to Werman. He said it was a piece of shit and he didn't want anything to do with it. And we got these guys to take pictures of an album cover over there, and they hated the cover. The Epic said, "This is a piece of shit. You guys made a big mistake."
So
and then later on, England, our fans in England were paying $30 a copy for Kamikaze yellow vinyl of Live at Budokan, and then it came to Canada, and the thing was gold before Epic even opened her eyes and woke up to the fact that this is going to be a big record.
But you know, we were just as naive about the whole thing. It was like it took everybody by surprise, except for the Japanese audience.
Right.
It was supposed to be just a sampler to the people that came to our shows, and all of a sudden it was like we were just trying to make the best record we could. You know, try to just do a live thing. And Robin and I and Bunny and Tom, we went to New York with Jack Douglas and mixed it in about 3 days.
Yeah,
and we didn't. You know,
it's like what you said at the beginning of the interview. It's like, you know, sort of going in through the outdoor, sort of, you know, like the sort of backwards way of doing things. You know,
no planning made it look like a good plan.
It's one of Cheap Trick's mistakes, but it's the best thing we've ever done, I guess. I don't know. I wouldn't say the best thing we've ever done, but definitely our biggest record.
Thank you.
Hit would later come off the Dream Police album in 1979 called Voices by Cheap Trick. But as Rick Nielsen and Robin Zander will affirm, coming up next, the unforeseen and unpredictable Live at Budokan album was about to scuttle all plans while Cheap Trick learned to surf a tsunami of popularity. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio with Robin Zander and Rick Nielsen for the essential best of Cheap Trick Part 2.
Hello, hello, I'm Robin Zander from Cheap Trick.
And this is Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick, and we're in the studio.
And I'm Redbeard, perusing the Cheap Trick at Budokan liner notes. They're amidst the usual cadre of tour managers, recording engineers, lighting and sound people, is a credit for interpreter. Rick Nielsen and Robin Zander say that she was essential.
Well, you see, we needed that because we couldn't speak to each other at the time.
Actually, I've seen her time and time again when we go back there. She's, you know, it's she did a big job there because you got to remember you're not only handling a crew of 15, 20 people that are just doing the recording part of it, you also have the live aspect to deal with, and all these guys that are working, they don't speak English.
And they never heard your music either. It's like, whoa.
It's the
Cheap Trick's The Way of the World is another excellent song on the Dream Police album, with great production from veteran producer Tom Werman. Ironically, this same producer had passed on Cheap Trick's trip to Japan in 1978, opting instead to focus on the band's next studio effort.
We asked Werman to go with us because we had done those two records with him, go to Japan because, they want to record us and, you know, let's make this record as good as possible. I can't go. He wouldn't go with us.
Hey, you got to remember, you know, you can knock the record company for taking the other side of the fence in this situation.
But in the States, we were nothing.
But you got to remember that they also knew and had heard the Dream Police album, and that's what they wanted to release. So, you know, I see their side of the story. It's like the Dream Police album is a great album, and you know, when they've got that in the can and they're looking at this album cover and listening to this live tape that we sent them, you know, of the Budokan thing, I can see their side of the story, really. You know, it's, you can slam them for it in a way, but at the same time, they had this great record in their back pocket, and they were sort of saying...
It was never supposed to be released anyplace right. except there. And we got plagued because of that, because the live record started to do real well, and we finished the Dream Police record, and then the reviewers, okay, now that we started to do, you know, the reviewers liked us, now the reviewers, since they had this live record that was doing well, then they heard that the Dream Police record had been finished, now all of a sudden that stuff is old material.
It took everyone, including the band, completely by surprise.
If you want my love, you got it. When you need my love, you got it. I won't hide it. I won't throw your love away. Oh, if you want my love, you got it. When you need my love, you got it. I won't hide it. I won't throw your love away.
complete with the Beatlesque falsetto octave leap by Cheap Trick lead singer Robin Zander, 1982's One-on-One album yielded If You Want My Love, You Got It. Through the first half of the 80s decade, Cheap Trick teamed first with legendary Beatles producer the late Sir George Martin and then with the multi-talented Todd Rundgren in hopes of matching the live Budokan and studio Dream Police projects in both radio airplay and sales, but to no avail. Finding the right combination proved elusive, according to first Robin Zander, then Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick.
No, actually, myself, being a bit naive during that whole period up until Budokan about stardom and being a rock star and all that stuff, if that's what we are, I didn't really learn that much then. I've learned a lot more since then.
I think
truthfully,
it's,
I have. I, at that time, I was sort of. I was in a little family of sorts, you know, and I was enjoying myself and everything. And then that happened, Budokan happened, and I got a taste of what it would be like to be a big, you know, huge success. And it was not all fun then. And then you can imagine, you know, especially in Japan, not being able to go anywhere, do anything, just stay in your room, don't even walk out of your room. Oh, you couldn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Nowhere.
I mean,
you couldn't walk out in the hallway.
You know, we're like the people that, at least me. I couldn't get a date to go somewhere. All of a sudden, I was like a big shot. Wait a minute, I'm the same guy.
Time's not sleeping, and time won't lose. You can't win, 'cause time can't lose.
You gotta do.
Tricks' Tonight It's You from 1985 Standing on the Edge album reminded us of their uncanny ability with the big hook, providing kindling for their biggest hit yet to ignite, still to come. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I am Redbeard with Rick Nielsen and Robin Zander in the studio for Cheap Trick's Essential Best Part 2.
Hello, hello, I'm Robin Zander from Cheap Trick.
And this is Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick, and we're in the studio.
And I'm Red Beard. One of the things I always loved about Cheap Trick is how its members have always worn their musical influences on their musical sleeves without apology. Perhaps that's why Cheap Trick previously was never even nominated for Rock and Roll Hall of Fame voting. But apparently, previous inductees like Nirvana, the Ramones, Guns N' Roses, Green Day, and eventual shoe-ins Soundgarden, they're all on record as being influenced by Cheap Trick's songcraft. Rick Nielsen exhibits real gratitude for the Rock Hall vote of confidence.
To this day, we're all surprised at how things have fallen into place. But at the same time, with hard work and going after it, that doesn't mean anything's going to happen. But with hard work and luck, it can happen. It's like you can't wait for a miracle to happen, but if you work at it, something can happen. And it was like it hit us, and we're still dumbfounded by it, and we're still dumbfounded by the newer success things that we've been doing. But it's not monetary success, because we still don't have any money. It's the fact that we're doing what we like, and after all these years, it's still the mystery. It's almost a joke. It's like we can't believe it. It's like unbelievable doing your radio show. It's like, I mean, we're not trying to be cocky about it. It's like, wow, funny, but you can't predict it.
Another night slowly closes in, and I feel so lonely. Touching heat freezing on my skin, I pretend you still hold me. I'm going crazy, I'm losing sleep, I'm empty, fighting way too deep over you. I can't believe you're gone. You were the first, you'll be the last. Wherever you go, I'll be with you. Whatever you want, I'll give it to you. Whenever you need someone to lay your heart and head upon, remember after the fire, after all the rain, I will be the flame. I will be the flame.
Watching shadows move across. Thank you.
there was a downside to Cheap Trick's The Flame on its ascent to the number one song in America in 1988, it would only be how the song's massive appeal may have actually overshadowed the half dozen great rockers on that album, Lap of Luxury. Cheap Trick lead singer Robin Zander savors the whole of the experience leading up to the Hall of Fame.
The thing I'm proud of the most about our careers up till now is the fact that we've had that sort of success that's as big as any success you could have, probably. And then to be able to go for that many years afterwards and come back and have that kind of success again, you know, it's like, you know, we've always had the same underlying thread of being a rock band. We got in the business to make a living at it because we love what we do. We didn't get in it to be like stars or millionaires. We got in it because we really like what we do, and if we can make a living at doing it and continue to make records, that's the greatest thing in the world. But to be able to continue that over the course of this many years, that's, I'm proud of that. And I don't want to sound like I'm bragging either, but I will brag about that, because it's not like, it's not being a pretentious superstar band, or it's not being this cult band that's only played on college radio. It's a neat band. It's a street band. It's a garage band. It's a band. It's like anybody that forms a band, you know, it's sort of
if
like
you do it from your heart.
Yeah,
you know, you got a chance to do something. And it's,
and I like it, and we're gonna fall flat on our face once in a while. But hey, we've had our ups and downs, and you know, being down ain't that bad, because you learn a lot.
Going back years and years and years, we looked for people that had that spark. We're not the greatest virtuosos on earth. We're not the best players there are. I mean, there's millions of people who can bowl technically every one of us in the band over, but at the same time, as a band, it's like, it's fun. It's still neat to do. We're still making records.
Individually, we're not the ultimate players or anything, but together, we're one of the best, I think.
That sounds like it's bragging again, but it's
without each other, I don't think it would be the same. You know, it's like, I like the idea of a band, and it's cool to have a band where you feel confident, you know, where we can walk into any situation, open up for any group or headline any show, and not worry about anything like, well, I don't know, we got this drummer who's no good or something, or we can't fire him because, you know, he formed the band,
there's no excuse. Four different personalities, we don't always get along great, but you know, once we start playing, it just seems to gel, and it sounds like that generic Spinal Tap answer, but it's that musical glue that and the struggling and working to get it all right means we fall flat on our face a million times. We have. I mean, we've been on a musical roller coaster. Been rich, been poor, been rich, been poor, been way poor.
Never gonna break.
Direction, Cheap Trick album, Bang Zoom Crazy Hello. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Robin Zander and Rick Nielsen. Congratulations, guys. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard. For Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2016, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.